Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schott. Happy to have Sri Taylor here with me today. Sri, how are you?
Good, good. Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you for coming. I know how busy you are, and I know it's been a let's just say hectic couple of weeks in our industry. So if you don't mind, though, would you tell everybody just a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
Yeah, sure. So I think of myself as a problem solver, first and foremost, in kind of generic terms. But I'm formally trained as a mathematician. That's been my background. And I've done a lot of different, like, wonderful things with that background. It's afforded me the opportunity to work in the medical field, solving problems and developing models that are related to, you know, pharmacokinetics. I've supported the DOD with those skill set. And now I'm leading a team of data scientists, machine learning experts, and others, all in the ever-changing world of AI. Mm-hmm. So it's been a wonderful, exciting kind of non-linear journey that I've been excited about for a very long time.
Absolutely. Well, and thank you so much. I appreciate that. And a fascinating background from, you know, medical to defense to mm-hmm. elsewhere. It's great that you're able to do all of that and come in and solve problems, right? Because that's what it's really about.
Yeah.
So as you think about having led teams in this space for a couple of years now, what are, one thing that you mentioned when we were doing our intake call, upfront call was, how diversity in AI, in a team, when you're building models and building, whether it's data models, AI, what have you, leads to a better end product. Can you speak on that and tell us
right.
why that's the case?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I think when it comes to solving problems, you don't want kind of a one size fits all. Mm-hmm. And the best way to steer clear of that is to have a variety of perspectives. And one of the analogies that I love to use with my team is, I don't know if you remember, like, back in the day, old school kaleidoscope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had that and I loved that. And that's all about fractals and mathematics. And so I was always fascinated by that. But when you look through a kaleidoscope, sometimes all it takes is the smallest little rotation or click. Mm-hmm. And you get something else that's, you know, just as profound or beautiful or intricate and insightful. And so that's how I think about diversity and when I'm building my teams. And the diversity is not two-dimensional, it's not three-dimensional. You can't always see it with your eyes. And so a lot of us will kind of say, this, that, and the other, I have a diverse team. But you really have to get to know people mm-hmm. and understand their perspective and their life experiences to understand what unique perspective can they bring to the table? What value can they add that may be a blind spot mm-hmm. or a gap for someone else on the team? So it's a very, it's a complex kind of a topic that takes time to understand. And it takes a lot of care and thoughtfulness to be able to address a problem holistically.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And it's an approach I've taken building teams in my mm-hmm. business, whether it's in the healthcare space, because I have a company there, or in the government contracting space, what have you. I'd never want, like, I just personally think that you get a, like, if you can get people from different backgrounds working together, rowing in the same direction, like, that's when the magic happens, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. I've talked to a couple of people and, you know, they're like, well, how do you do it? And, you know, in my background, I work with a lot of data scientists and computer scientists. And sometimes people are looking for pseudocode or an algorithm that just goes boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. But in my journey, I've done that before, but there's also an art because we're talking about people here. And so you have to be engaging, you have to be open, you have to be willing to kind of step into some of the messiness at times. You have to be good with chaos and understand, you know, kind of when to lean in, when to pull back, when to charge, when to stay still. So there is a bit of an art to it that comes with, in my opinion, you know, just experience and wisdom.
Yeah. Can you give give us some examples of, or an example of a time where having a more diverse team directly led to a better product or better end product?
Oh, wow. Well, that happens kind of like a lot there. So I'll think back to a time when I was more hands-on keyboard and developing mathematical models. And we were developing PBPK models, physiologically based pharmacokinetic models. Mm-hmm. And in developing those models, you need to understand and, you know, read the literature for a lot of the variables and parameters that need to go into the model. Well, sometimes you can find a wide range, a wide spectrum. Mm-hmm. And not knowing kind of, you know, why some variables may be the way they are, you know, the detailed information may or may not be there. But when we would run these models and you get output, you're then also tasked with the responsibility of interpreting the outcome. It's not just, oh, I have an outcome and let me move on to the next thing. You take it, you look at it, you change some things around and you make sure you understand it. Well, I think in this particular team, there were all people from all sorts of backgrounds, different nationalities, different genders. And the things that we would bring up to say, you know, kidneys and this, and or looking at this paper that was cited for a particular parameter or variable may have been, you know, written in the early 30s or mm-hmm. whatnot. Well, if you think back to, you know, who was a part of scientific experimentation at that time, that gives you a sense as to how much you should really lean into that variable, how much, you know, we would also do like sensitivity analysis on the data or on the variables. And so I think that even in something that is as codified or, you know, as much data rich as it is in the medical field, you need a diverse team to be able to ask the right questions, because that may not have been front and center for someone else who may be of a certain generation mm-hmm. or a certain gender or certain background, certain nationality. So people's stories are so important, and it's important to get to know people so that, you know, when they share a perspective, it gives you, it just kind of creates more dimensionality to it.
Absolutely. I appreciate yeah. that example. It's fascinating. I didn't think about how you would weight the results of scientific surveys based on when they
come. Oh, yeah.
It makes a lot of sense when you think about it. But it does. And what you said reminded me actually of a book that I read that was actually brought up, mentioned to me by a former guest over the summer, mm-hmm. or last summer, on Robots and Red Tape. And it's, you know, the book itself is, I'm not going to plug his book, but in it, he cited somebody that was this gentleman, I want to say in the 80s or 90s, was doing a lot. He was going to and was embedded in different research laboratories, trying like the mm-hmm. 50 in the country or something over a couple of years. And he was trying to figure out why some research laboratories were more productive than others. Right. Hmm. And interestingly, so what he found was that this gentleman found that when you had professionals from you had research labs doing research on multiple topics. You had, you know, you had people from like a medical background and like a physicists, mathematicians, all coming in working on different problems in very different areas, and had collaborative meetings where they could essentially bring up problems that they were having. The ideas that they got from professionals that were outside of their area of expertise were often the ones that solved the problems and solved them quickly. And they actually spoke about a very specific example where there were two labs that were working, that he was embedded with both, and he had NDAs with both, so he couldn't like tell them that were trying to work on the same problem. Right, one had a very diverse. And I mean that from a skill set perspective, an expertise perspective, background. And the other was very, very hyper specific on one, like one background. And actually, the people that were more diverse from a skill set perspective and an expertise perspective solved the problem a couple of months faster, 6 or 7 months faster. And now this gentleman is sitting in meetings where this other team is trying to solve a problem he heard solved, and sitting there and listening to it all. Right. And it's like, it's fascinating because, you know, like when I got into healthcare, I started my mental health company in 2020. My only experience in healthcare was as a patient. I had no experience like even working in a doctor's office. I didn't know what a CPT code was or an MPI number was. I had no idea. Right. And, I I've been able to learn a lot about how the medical field works, but I've also been able to bring my background and experience in other industries to bear. And, you know, I think we have a much more efficient organization as a result.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the thing that I love about what you said is that you have been a patient, and what is more important, like, no matter what your medical business does, you need, you know, typically there's a patient involved. And if you are able to come from that perspective and you have like the empathy, and you know, a lot of times, you know, you think about companies that are in competition for one another, they're selling the same thing, but the ones that really do well are the ones that connect with their audience. And they may be a niche. You know, and it may be boutique, but the ones that people, you know, that kind of outlast the others are those that have found that human connection.
Absolutely. And I remember the first time I really thought about it from that perspective was actually, I watched a very famous TED talk by Simon Sinek. And as do I, but his very, very simply that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And if you go around and you tell people why you do it,
why,
and talk about the mission associated with it, you're going to attract the right people, which is what I do when I talk about Robots and Rights Ape and do the introduction. That directly comes from that, right? Like, you were on the receiving end of my spiel associated with it, right?
I love that. I love that. And you know, that's something that's interesting, though, because I've had that's been a challenge for me, like for a long time, to be able to come and talk about myself because I'm introverted. The company that I work for, Elder Research, one of our main core values is humility. And that's like why I really love it here, is because we're surrounded by a lot of smart people. But you don't have to go around, you know, competing with one another or, you know, vying for this one spot or whatnot. So when I'm able to engage with people without, you know, having to roll out the credentials, as I solve problems, like that's what I do. You know, now there are a lot of different types of problems, and I'm not an expert in, you know, all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but that's what I do, that's what I enjoy. And it's nice to be able to lead with that, but not all environments welcome that. That's the thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They don't. And I think that there are absolutely environments that are very competition based, right? And I think that that can be helpful. But I think that for me, like, and especially when you're, I know you guys are bigger than my organizations, but you're not big by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
You know, and like, but especially when you're looking to add people and grow as an organization, those are so like, Yeah, my hiring rule historically, I've always called it the 10-40-50 rule. I think anytime you hire somebody, 10% of your decision will be based on things like education, certifications, right? If you're hiring an accountant, do they need a CPA license, right? If you're hiring somebody at DOD, what level clearance do they need? Those are hard requirements, right? Your 40% is going to be your hands-on skill set and whether you have the ability to do the job. The other half is all soft skills. It's personality fit. It's corporate culture fit. Are they going to take an unsolved problem personally? Does it matter to them as much as it matters to you? Are they going to show up early? Are they going to stay late? Are they going to do the things that are needed to be done to accomplish the mission, no matter what that is? And that's the important part. Like, let's be clear. Yeah. Like, I will always hire the less experienced person with the right attitude over the more experienced with the wrong, 100% of the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that is so just very well stated, very articulated that perfectly. I mean, when people who are interested in elder research come through the interview process, sometimes they will interview with me. Sometimes, you know, I empower my people to just go ahead and make that decision. Sometimes they will ask me to interview if maybe they're, on the fence, or if, you know, they just don't have enough people to kind of do like a tiebreaker. And I'll be totally honest with you, Nick, like I can tell within the first 5 minutes or so, I can tell how the individual shows up, how they kind of think about things and how they engage. And it's typically a very quick process. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't typically tell people that because you know, I'm looking at my calendar and it's like, oh, I'm supposed to talk to this person for, you know, an hour or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten to the point that I'm telling my assistant, please don't schedule me for hour interviews. It does not take that long, especially for our process. We have a pretty robust process. And by the time they get to me, I know what I'm looking for when it comes to will they fit in with my team as a whole. So, yeah.
Yeah. And having been hiring people for, I mean, over a decade now, 15 years now, I can generally tell whether or not I'm going to put somebody in front of a client. Within 4 or 5 minutes on the phone, easily, without question, right? I think most people that have a back, because like I came up in the staffing world, right? And I still do, we still do some of that work. We're working in, like I said, a couple of different agencies now as well. You know, I think that most people, and I think this is part of why folks in the recruiting space have such a bad name, is because I think they're always trying to sell people jobs, right? Yeah. They see their job is like, I have this job I need to fill. I'm going to go find somebody and sell it to them. And then I'm going to sell the client on them. That's not a way to build a sustainable relationship, right? My job is to disqualify people, right? My job is to tell people why you don't want this job. And if they still do, now we can talk, right?
Yeah.
Literally. And, you know, and like, I mean, I'm kicking off a project right now for a large municipality in the country. And they're notoriously difficult to deal with. And so like, as we're interviewing, you know, people running programs, I'm just laying everything out. Like, this is what you're going to walk into. This is where we are. We have 4 bosses internally in 4 different agencies. It's a mess. It's all over the place. And their relationships are all, it's in like the existing infrastructure is not great. And so but if I tell you all that and you're like, oh no, I'm interested. I'm like, that's the person, right? That's the one you want.
Yes. And it's interesting as you, I know that this was just kind of like an example that you were given, but as you were talking, but this is what I do. I'm taking in this information and I'm creating a mathematical, an optimization problem. And I'm like, these are the constraints. These are the assumptions. These are the givens. Mm-hmm. And this is what we want to maximize, minimize, or optimize. Mm-hmm. And that is so exciting. And it's interesting that you said that, you know, difficult client or whatnot. And I hear people say that a lot. And whenever I hear that, I'm just drawn in. And I tell, you know, I do like to think that I have a bit of a sense of humor, but I tell folks on my team, I tell them, you know, it takes one to know one. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm a difficult person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how to deal with me.
Yeah.
You know, I know just kind of like those buttons and whatnot. And so, again, this is all about perspective and life experiences. I'm sure we all have had people in life who we would classify as difficult. And what I tell my team is, you know, nope, they're not difficult. They're just misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
Because right. when I get there, I'm going to talk to them. And my goal is to understand what it is that is kind of giving you that heartburn. And let's go in and decompose it, pull it apart, and solve it together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing. I love that you're already building a model based on what we're talking about.
yeah, the mental model for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, as we think about a lot of these workforce issues, right? And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, let's be very clear. There's a lot of work out there from a data perspective now, more so than there ever has been. I've been told that data science was invented in the 90s and just we just didn't catch up from a technology perspective until more recently. But as you start thinking about this, right, like, and, you know, you can't, like, unlike, you know, some more, let's just say, administration or administrative IT positions, I think, like, being a good data scientist or data engineer is not something you can really boot camp like, you know, a SharePoint administrator, a Salesforce administrator, mm-hmm. where you can run somebody through a 6-month boot camp and have like an entry level person at the end who's not going to be amazing, but they'll be able to come in and do some of the jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding the increased amount of data work out there and the increased focus in AI. What are some of the things that you would think about from like a workforce planning perspective that we should be, you know, looking at or implementing to make sure that we're bringing the right people into this space?
Yeah, very good question. Very good question. And this is something that I think about on a continual basis. So when it comes to the boot camps, or, you know, some people went through a more traditional route of learning data science, what I'm looking for in their resume, but also in engaging with them, is the ability to solve problems, but the critical thinking skills. I really want to make sure that when you hit a roadblock, or if your code has bugs, that you're not just going to slack somebody and say, hey, what did you do for this? I want to know that you can think through a problem methodically, and then be able to, you know, go to someone for help and tell them what you did as well. Communicate that to them. And so that's another big piece of it, too, is just the communication. A lot of times we think of communication as being more, you know, external, with external, like facing clients or whatnot. But the communication also happens internally within the team, because there needs to be team building. There needs to be cross-functional communication. And so all of those things are important. It's not, you know, good enough that, you know, you can write code. It's not good enough that you went to an Ivy League school. There are a combination of things. And so going back to the boot camps, they serve a purpose. Now I'm a mathematician, so I am biased. And my husband is a physicist. So I'm like really biased.
Mm-hmm.
So that just goes to tell you, like, my span of friends, like, are pretty much like in STEM. I do have a few friends who are not STEM.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you spend as much time as we have in school and going all the way through to the PhD, is a significant sacrifice and commitment
mm-hmm.
to immersing yourself into that world. And so when you do a boot camp, you're not completely immersed, depending on kind of like what your other background is or was. Now, but the way that I've adapted is that these individuals absolutely bring value, but it is my job to kind of figure out their place in my ecosystem. Because if I have someone who has been traditionally trained in political science, who then went to not necessarily a boot camp, but a really specific program that was like an abridged program. It wasn't like a 4-year program or, you know, 2-year master's or whatnot. But what it's taught me is that different people, I think of my data scientists as being different flavors. Mm-hmm. And so I have some that are a little bit heavier in machine learning. I have some that are a little bit heavier in engineering. And so as we are, I'm looking to build a team, I'm asking myself, what flavor of a data scientist or of an AI specialist do I need? And that flavor is also made up of their personality, their strengths, their weaknesses, their also their professional development goals. I take that into account because I'm asking myself, is this going to open up opportunities for this individual and help propel them? Because then that goes back into retainment. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to be able to keep this person around if they understand that I'm investing in them and this is going to help their professional growth. So again, so it's like this optimization problem just kind of like grows and grows and grows and grows. It is so dynamic, always changing.
Always. And I love your focus on professional development as well. Cause as I look for folks and talk to people, right. Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm, it doesn't matter what kind, and like, it doesn't matter if I'm hiring a data scientist or a program manager, I'm running people through the same process. Right. Cause it's like some of the words change, some of the questions change, but it's like, people are people are people. And if you know how to screen people, like, it doesn't matter. Right. So one of the things I always, always personally look for, right, is why do you want to make a move and what do you want out of your next position? Because I want to understand, like, are you looking to gain more skills? Have you been at a place for a while? You're static and bored. Like, what is it that you're, or are you just looking for another job because your contract's ending? Like, what is it you want? So I can understand and have a more, you know, I can represent them better and have a better conversation with folks. I love your analogy relating to different flavors of data folks, because you're absolutely right. Like, I also think that you know, for instance, somebody with a political science background is going to be better on some projects because of the people that they're going to be dealing with as an end client, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've had someone who, you know, had spent some time on Capitol Hill, where they're going to bring a very different perspective than someone who has taken a more traditional route and only worked in, say, you know, computer science. Mm-hmm. Someone who has an undergraduate degree in statistics is going to bring a different element than, say, someone who's coming from a government background. And just understanding all of that and what motivates people, what drives them. That's another thing that we do spend time when someone joins the team. I like assessment too. And they're not a shortcut to getting to know people, but it does help people raise their own level of self-awareness. And that's important. Mm-hmm. It's not only important that I get to know you, but I want you to continue to get to know yourself as you grow and evolve too. And so I bring in different assessments to kind of help all of us understand ourselves and each other better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that. And I love your approach to team building. That's fantastic. More managers should probably be like you. I'll poke that way. You know, I mean, you mentioned some of the boot camps, and some, you know, some do well. You know, what do they do well now, and where can they improve?
Well, they span the gamut so much. I haven't really done like an assessment of the boot camps. So I don't really have an answer for that. Because the program is not so much the boot camp is not so much of what I'm evaluating as it is the person. And so, you know, and my apologies for not just kind of giving you a clean answer on this, but it's a little complex, and different programs have different offerings. And this goes back to kind of that self-awareness. What is it that you need to strengthen? What skills do you need to strengthen? And so that's going to kind of dictate which program you go to. Some programs are more focused on say, the math and the statistics of it. And so you may do a deep dive there. Others are more focused on, okay, we're going to give you that. Just trust us on that. And we're going to give you, we're going to go through more application of using this. Now, the challenge with that, in my opinion, now I am an applied mathematician. So in going through that whole process, I absolutely had to learn all of the theoretical mathematics, all of the foundational mathematics. And then as an applied mathematician, I then began to learn how to apply it, but I could not skip, you know, those fundamental steps there. And so sometimes when you go through a boot camp, if you are one who is afraid of math or afraid of statistics, or you don't really like, you know, coding, or you only code in one language, you know, that's a bit of a red flag there that you could kind of dig deeper on to kind of understand what those barriers mean for you and what boot camp or program is going to help you address those and get over them.
So what do you think if you're talking to somebody now who is, you know, either considering a career change into the data and AI space, or is, you know, say they're in high school or, you know, early in college and they want to get into it. What are the skills, having done this successfully for a long time, what are the skills that you think make a very effective data science, you know, data professional?
Oh, wow. So I'm not sure if I mentioned this in my intro, but I did spend some time at Georgetown University leading their math and statistics graduate program. And so part of my responsibility was to identify each incoming class of graduate students. There are a lot of applications, a lot of excellent applications on paper. And so as I would evaluate these candidates without having met them, and they're coming from all over the world, the fundamentals would be, you know, calculus, having all three stages of calculus, and linear algebra. And to some of your listeners, that may or may not mean a whole lot, but those are kind of like some of the fundamental courses that we look for coming into a program like this. Even if you're going into statistics, you have to have the mathematical foundation. And so I would look at these elements, parameters on the applications, and we would do our best. There was a committee. We'd do our best to select the incoming class. Incoming class would come in. I would teach one of the intro classes in deterministic mathematics. Now, this is a course where if you have a math background, it should be pretty straightforward. If you're coming in from a different background where math was not, you know, that heavily favored or whatnot, it is going to be a challenge. But in teaching this class, I taught it for for a few semesters there. Whenever I would teach it from a more traditional perspective, the students were just getting it, And I was like, oh my God, everybody in the class has, you know, they're on track to get A's here. And so then I said, well, sure, you're doing them a disservice to not challenge them, because that's the whole point of college. We want to push the boundaries and help you grow there. And so the way that I did that is I would begin to have group projects. Mm-hmm. And the group projects were a challenge because you have the whole, you know, public speaking, working with the group and all those things. Well, then I would not give the group a closed form or a well-defined problem. Mm-hmm. I would tell them, you go find the problem. And the thing is that problems in the real world are quite messy. Mm-hmm. And so they would have to go through the process of refining and asking questions to put the necessary boundaries and constraints in place in order to then be able to solve the problem. And what they began, and the students kind of like hated this because they had never been taught this. They didn't know how to do it. And it's like, well, welcome to the real world. Right. You know, you're going to run into situations where you have not been trained to do it, but you have to use critical thinking skills and figure out how are you going to get from here to the end. And so they began to, I mean, it didn't, each class, I think you could tell some of them were okay with that challenge, but there were others who I would need to pull back because I could tell that this was a bit too much, that it was not structured in a way that they could just, you know, go right to it. But that gave me information. That was intel for me.
So those are the ones that are going to be the professors?
They can be professors, or, you know, they could be a data scientist that, you know, you just kind of feed them those, you know, well-defined problems to solve. But, you know, it's important for them to have that self-awareness. And like I was saying, it gives me intel as well.
No, and I joke about that. You know, I love your desire to bring real world into school. As somebody who, I mean, I went to a couple of colleges. I also got kicked out of a couple of colleges, Sri, but.
All good. Uh-huh. Life experiences.
There we go. The thing that always bothered me about school, and this is like, you know, in general, is I didn't like, first, in school, I feel like especially when you're teaching theory, you get taught theory in black and white, right? And like, a great example I've always used is, you know, think about forms of government, right? There's, you know, you talk like the big ones that we talk about now, whether it's socialism, communism, capitalism, these different philosophies, right? You can talk about that all you want. There is no pure implementation of that because the real world is messy, right? And where I always had problem with just school in general is that, like, we're talking about all these things in a vacuum without anything connected to each other. Because, like, what I love and one of the things that I'm really good at is because I do so many things and have touched so many things, I'm able to look at problems and bring different perspectives to them. And I also think of myself as a problem solver, right? And be like, you know, a delivery problem, a personnel problem. Hey, how are we, you know, delivering these services to folks that need it in the Baltimore County area, right? You can't debate whether or not nothing is black and white. It's all gray scale. And I live in areas of gray, right? I do this and this, not I'm just this, right? And I think. But I have difficulty at times communicating with people that are very, very black and white in their world because I don't think that way or talk that way. And I can that I also think that breeds inflexibility. And I think that one of the most important things to being successful is the ability to adapt and, you know, adapt to changes and adapt to real world situations as they come up.
Totally agree with that. The interesting thing about that is that, I mean, I've come into contact with people who do in their world is black and white. And I can identify those people, as I'm sure probably you can as well. And what I do is I step into their world because I've lived in that world. So this is more like me being flexible. So I flexed. I go into that world. I communicate in a very structured and concise way, step out of that world, then you go over to the gray area where maybe some of your business users, end users are living, and they're like, I don't know what's going on there. And so I also see myself as kind of like a liaison or a bridge between different worlds. Mm-hmm. So it is a very useful and bit of a unique skill to have once you know how to use it, control it, and manage it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is, and I love that. One of the big things that I believe in is meeting people where they are from a communication.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
is what, you know, what you say is a lot less important than how you say it. Because if you're not saying it in a way that it's going to be received, or it's going to say, or if you say it in a way that's going to set somebody off, they're not going to hear you, and they're not going to take that feedback, positive or negative, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 1,000%. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that, that is something that I struggle. I think in all the areas that I look to my team to kind of, you know, excel and to grow in and to thrive in, I have to hold myself to those same standards. I rarely, if ever, ask my team to do something that I cannot do or will not do myself. And communication, I will say, is an area that I'm very open with my team. I'm like, look, this is not my strong suit. I've improved over the years, and I know that I may have some blind spots, but I invite feedback.
Yep.
And it's something that I do to make sure that we have two-way communication. Mm-hmm. I'm not that one to just, you know, bark orders. I can be. Mm-hmm. But I've come a long way since those days, you know? And so I think you get, this goes back to kind of, you know, being a leader and how to get the best out of your team and just listening, but also kind of putting in those boundaries for communication and saying, this is how I like to communicate. Like what's your preference? And mm-hmm. then kind of go from there. It can evolve. It can change. But mm-hmm. if it changes, just let me know.
Yep.
You know, something so simple.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm with you. I just talk to me. And I also am very upfront with my teams and tell them, like, when I'm not good at something, right? Like, mm-hmm. detail-oriented, it's not my strong suit. You know what I mean? Like, when I manage my own calendar, I end up triple booking myself because that's just what happens, right? Because I'm not good at that. But like, you know, I'm great at the upfront ideation of things. One of my favorite parts of any project or any problem is when you, like, you see the pieces. And like, I'm doing this now with a big vehicle pursuit. I'm in the process of putting a team together, HHS you know, like I have a bunch of pieces, and I'm just not sure how they fit together yet. And I love that part. I love putting a puzzle. Yeah, right.
A puzzle. Absolutely.
I'm great at that. Implementation is, you know, like I'm, you know, like a hire a program manager.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, at different phases of my life, I was doing different things. So, you know, when working on the degrees in math, like being detail oriented was an absolute requirement, had to do it. And I still have that ability. And, you know, my people, my team, they kind of hate it when they send me a spreadsheet and I'm like, cell CC32. Mm-hmm. Like, where did that number come from? You know? Mm-hmm. But I have to be in a certain headspace for that. You know, what I do on my day-to-day now, especially engaging with people, it's like different muscles for that than the others. And whenever I'm using different muscles, it's like I have to have a different environment, mm-hmm. almost like I have to have a different cup of tea, depending on, you know, what it is I'm doing. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I do love that. And I've always been like a math, personally speaking for myself, mm-hmm. like a math perspective, like that's easy for me, right? Like I can, mm-hmm. you know, I can get A's in calculus, no problem. I could get A's mm-hmm. in calculus, no problem. It just took work, but like I understand the theory, I understand, but I was always glad that I had to show my work because like I'd get all the way there and then like drop a number somewhere and it's like, and this is like, you know, it's just not, again, like, it's just not what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right.
Like I made a conscious decision end of 22, beginning of 23 to like focus and spend as much of my time as possible doing the things that I'm good at. Right. Cause there are things mm-hmm. that I bring to organizations and things that I do that other people just can't generally.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
But like, you know, like entering, like managing hours and contractors' hours and things like that. I can do that, but it's not the best of my time. I should be talking to people, right? Because that's like that's something that I'd and I'd much rather do that. Some people, not all of them.
Well, you know, that's very insightful. So let me ask you a question, Nick. Like, what was your journey? How did you discover that about yourself? Because that wasn't just like a, you know, flip the switch kind of a thing.
No, I did it for years. I like for the first, you know, like 5 or 6 years of running my, you know, running businesses, I wanted to do everything and be involved in everything. Right. And I think one of the things that really helped me like be more comfortable with letting go of control was that I was in like was when I started a mental health company, and now I'm legally not allowed to or qualified to provide the service, right? So I have to come back, right? And then, you know, and then frankly, the like I made mistakes here and there, right? I still do when it comes to detail work. But the last straw for me was I had a contractor on, I had somebody on contract in New York City. I'm sorry, in New York, right? They were in state of New York, right? And Artemis was at the time a Maryland-based company. And I accidentally set his payroll up to, because I was doing all the payroll entry too and everything. Right. I was paying Maryland his state taxes instead of New York. And that was like the last straw, like in because it had been a lot of little things. But then it's like, OK, now I need to come because like it's not like Maryland is going to give you that money back until you file taxes. And I mean, it all went to the like it was essentially just an early tax payment. But I had to go, you know, come up with $20,000 to give New York because I made a mistake. Right. Things like that. Where and it's not the only situation that happened like that. It's just the most recent one, was the straw that broke the camel's back of understanding that, you know what, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. I should not be doing this. And so that's when you hire I hired an outsourced payroll company. What I pay them, is worth every penny, and it's incredibly inexpensive for the service, right? Like it's not I don't have to worry about that. If I'm spinning somebody up in a new state, they'll go and register for with the state holder number, the unemployment number, because there's unemployment number get set up in there. If I don't have somebody there, they'll either close it out or file zero returns, because like Virginia's a state where even if you don't have somebody on payroll, if you are registered with a withholding number and an unemployment number, they expect you to file zeroed out returns on a monthly basis. And if not, they're going to charge you money. And like, it's a couple of bucks, but it's like, then I'm like, why am I paying them money? That's kind of what broke. That's what broke the camel's back, and how I got here. Then it was also sitting and realizing that, you know what, like you want me to network, like networking, I can go out and talk to people, right? Put me in a room full of, you know, should I be like looking at government forecasts and sources of RFIs, those responses. Like those are the things I should be doing. I should be working relationships and building, and it allowed me to things like that. Gave me the bandwidth to, you know, do robots and red tape and to have more forward facing conversations, because I'm not worried about something that I'm not inherently good at to begin with.
Right. Or you don't have the time or the interest. That's the other thing. I didn't mention that I was an entrepreneur. I don't think I did. I can't remember as well. So for about 15 years, I had business partners, and you know, we ran our own consulting firm, and that was a huge learning curve. And to your point, you know what I'm talking about. Like I've done everything from A to Z because it had to be done. And when you're just getting started, you're the one. And then you quickly learn that the risk of me doing this and, you know, how it could go so wrong, I'd rather just invest and have others, professionals, do that, you know? But it reminded me, as you were talking, about a book called The E-Myth. I can't remember the author right now, but The E-Myth is a book, is the E is entrepreneurship. The myth about entrepreneurship, basically, you know, spoiler alert here. The E-Myth is that you should be working on your business and not in your business. That's the difference of being an owner versus a worker.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So,
and I think that's a really profound message for a lot of people who start their own business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the goal is to hire people to replace me, right? In every aspect of it. Business, right? And then I just manage them. And then, you know, you get a couple of, and them being, say, it's a sales organization, then you're managing a salesperson, right? And then you hire a couple of them, you hire a sales manager, and then you're building layers of management on top. Yeah. Having been an entrepreneur for a long time, Sri, I assume people ask constantly what, you know, whether they should start a business, or they tell you, oh my God, I have this idea and what's the advice you always give them? What's your go-to piece of advice for aspiring entrepreneurs?
Oh, wow. I don't know if there's one piece of advice as much as it is a conversation. Mm-hmm. Again, and just trying to, you know, get a better sense of their why. Like, why are you really doing this? Is it because you want more freedom? You want more money? Mm-hmm. It can't be because you want more time.
Yeah.
Because that will not happen. Can't be that. So, yeah. So I would say, you know, understanding your why as to your embarking upon this, and finding out how committed, because you've got to be committed. And it's not just you. If you have a partner, family, like, this is a team sport in that regard. Because, you know, I had the conversation with my husband. We talked about it at the time. We had two very small kids. And, you know, I'm in the D.C. area. So childcare was what? That's another mortgage. And so all of these things have to be a part of that conversation, and thinking more than just about, oh, I don't want a boss, or I don't want to have to answer to anybody, or I want to be my own boss. There are going to be times where, you know, Where are you going to get payroll? How are you going to make payroll? Yeah. And if you don't make payroll, understand the implications of that. Your reputation goes to crap real quick with the people who, you know, because, like, that doesn't fly. You're the entrepreneur, not them, you know? So you have to have a good deal of resilience.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of like, on the shelf, like in the bunker, like deep, mm-hmm. that you can reach back and pull out at any given moment.
Yep. You know, I think something that a lot of people don't think about is that you don't have coworkers, right? Like, I have partners, mm-hmm. I have employees, I have clients, I don't have mm-hmm. peers. And anybody right. that could be considered a peer, unless they're in, if they're in the industry, if they're smaller than you, they're trying to knock you off. If they're bigger than you, they're
yeah.
a threat. And if they're not in the industry, they don't really get it, but, like, they might mm-hmm. a little bit. And, you know, I think, like, the loneliness associated with it is difficult.
Yes.
Something that's not talked about, I don't think, a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I think that, like, whenever somebody asks me, I just tell them, if you're asking me for my approval, you shouldn't do it. Right. Like, I'm happy to give you advice, but if it's not if it's not something that you, like, need to do, you shouldn't do it, because like, it is the most difficult thing I've ever done. Hands down. Right. It's you can't show your employees how you really feel. You have to mask that and present a positive mm-hmm. image, no matter what, mm-hmm. even when things are going to hell and you're like, mm-hmm. I don't know, like, I'm $10,000 short for payroll in 3 days and I'm not sure how I'm paying y'all, but you can't tell people that.
No, you cannot. You cannot. And, you know, it's when I was running my firm, I had two business partners. And so, I mean, I don't know, you know, what your situation is, but there are a lot of solopreneurs out there too, who don't have partners. And, you know, there are pros and cons to both, but Yeah, a lot of different considerations. And to your point, if you're having to go around like searching for the answer outside of yourself, it might not be the right time.
No, but also just like, if you're going to do it, just do it. Like it's, I say it's the most difficult thing I've ever done, but I wouldn't do anything else. I just wouldn't.
Yeah.
Or that's me, right? Yeah. Personally, I couldn't imagine going to work for somebody because, well, I think we talked about that a little bit before the call. Like I'm not great. I'm not great at being an employee. No, and but I think that's partially probably a function of me and partially a function of not having had a boss in 10 years or a job with a boss in 10 years. So, but before we do wrap up today, Sheree, I just get a curious, is there anything I missed? Anything you'd like to add? Anything you'd like to point you'd like to make that I didn't give you the opportunity to make?
Well, I mean, I think we're good. The last piece of it that you were just going to mention, I think, as I went from being an entrepreneur to Georgetown, I got into academia and now started Missing Consulting. And I had an opportunity to re-enter the workforce or, you know, pick up my company again. And my network is very important to me. But the CEO of Elder Research, Gerhard, he had reached out to me saying, hey, you know, I think we're going to have an executive position to come open sometime soon. Do you know of anybody? You know the company, you know how we work, you know our values. And I thought on that for a very long time. I was like, oh, that could be tricky because, you know, I know the technical skill set that you're looking for, but I also know the values that you're looking for. And then it just like I had an epiphany. I was like, maybe this is an opportunity for me to kind of go back. And I am one, you know, I always thought that once I started my own business that I would kind of stay in that. But then Georgetown, I had an invitation to come to Georgetown. I was like, I can't turn that down. I'm not going to turn that down. Once in a lifetime kind of a thing. And so then I had this invitation or, you know, this conversation. And I have been very blessed, very highly favored in that regard, to end up at a place, the Elder Research, where the culture is a good fit. And I feel I still have kind of like this entrepreneurial drive that is honored and that is respected in my space, you know? And yeah, definitely shout out to Elder Research for creating that because it's not common at all. And I love being there and love working with the team.
Oh, fantastic. And you guys have a great reputation in the industry. About y'all. Believe me, I do. I'm familiar with a lot of the work you guys do. And I really appreciate you coming on. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, same. Thank you too, Nick. I'm so glad to have done this.
Absolutely. Everybody, thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape. Hope you're having a great day.